I'll take it. But I need it done on mine as well. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Bailey. Special thanks to Kristen and to Robin Millay for inspiring this great invitation. This is a terrific choice to have me here tonight. Thank you very much. I will hold tight to the essence for a little while before I start to do my customary moving around the room. I want to introduce my colleague tonight. This is Sarah Inlow, who's going to help me. She is the director of our education program at the American Shakespeare Center. So I also want to pitch the American Shakespeare Center to you. You know, the fee you give me here is not overwhelming. So I should like to invite you all to help make it worth my trip by going over the mountain to Stanton, Virginia. It is a mere 40 minutes away. You'll be surprised to discover that the Interstate 64 goes both ways. That's very nice. And you will find a lovely town there and the most beautiful theater you have ever seen, but more on that later. We have brochures to give you at the end of this, and we hope that you will go. How many of you have ever been to the Blackfriars Playhouse? Well, I wasn't kidding, was I, about how pretty the theater is. It's a beautiful theater. And we have a wonderful, wonderful company there. My talk tonight is not to in any way denigrate movies. I love movies. I'm a movie buff, and I taught film for many years at James Madison University. In fact, I used to believe that I would help be responsible for the first great Shakespeare on film that would be made. It took me a long time to realize when I would fulminate to my students about how great this particular Shakespeare film was, that it didn't even make it into my top 500 films, and yet I was telling them how great it was. Shakespeare and film aren't really conducive, and part of what I'd like to talk about tonight is why. But in the sense of what we can do about enjoying what I think is an entertainment form that is in peril, and that is theater. So I'm going to spend a little time talking about some theater history and its connection to film, very brief time, and then I'm going to talk about what plays can do that movies can't, and which I think they should do more of. And underlying all of this, perhaps not surprisingly, will be the argument that you should get your butts over the mountain and see it done right. So I just want to argue in it. I want to tell you in advance that's my thesis, and we'll go from there. Statistics show that the audience for live drama is dropping precipitously. My age people go to plays. much more than people your age go to plays. And my age people used to go to plays more than you are now. But the statistics just continue to drop. This is of importance to me, of course, because I run a theater. But it's also, I think, about something else. So I want to start by saying that the history of theater, as I see it, and this connection to film, is the story of light. It's really a story of lighting. You are, and I asked that Bailey sort of change the seating so you could see each other. Can you see each other? Can you see each other? Like, for example, would you just look incredibly bored right now? Just bored. You. Yeah, no, just, you know, like almost asleep. Do it for me. Just sort of asleep. Right. Now, how many can see that? You can see that, right? Because he's turned a little bit, you can see it. And you can see it because the lights are on. It's a really big deal. Any of you plan to be teachers? Any of you plan to be lawyers? Raise your hand. Yeah, okay. All right. Let me just say to you that if you're in a courtroom and you see one of your jurors falling asleep while you're talking, something's not going well. And you need to know it. But on the other hand, if you see, and you can see it in a courtroom because they leave the lights on, if you see eyes on yours, as I can see yours right now, or on, I know you're listening. I know you're listening. If someone's leaning forward, body posture, it's like, good sign. Okay, continue. We read an audience, and we read, if we're performers, if we're speakers, if we're lawyers, if we're teachers, we read audiences. And we may not realize that we are doing it, but here's the other thing. Audiences are reading themselves. Because one person asleep tells the rest of the audience that there might be something boring going on. I do not understand, this is a personal thing, I teach a course in pedagogy. I do not understand why it is that any teacher lets a student sleep in class. I used to throw erasers at any student who fell asleep in class, and they knew, thank you very much, thank you very much. And they knew it was coming. Until I got sent to the vice president at JMU. So now I have this other thing I do. I go up to a sleeping student and wake him. And I have a couple of dollars in my hand. And I say, I am so sleepy. Could you help me out and get me a coffee? And I said, and by the way, get yourself one too. It seems to be quite encouraging to everyone that you know, so they're not humiliated exactly. They get a coffee out of it. I get a coffee out of it. But the most important thing, I get the sleeper out of the room. It's devastating when somebody does that. And if you've ever taught or if you've ever stood in front of a room where they're sleeping, you can understand what I'm talking about. What does this have to do with drama? Everything. Here's an interesting fact. William Shakespeare, or to me it is, but they don't give you a PhD for being interested in things everybody's interested in, I'll tell you. Shakespeare died in 1616. And you may be aware that he played either in the Globe, which had an open air and therefore was lit by the light, you know, it was lit by the sun, or he played in the Blackfriars Playhouse, which was his indoor theater. And they had candlelight, candelabra like this, and they couldn't turn it off. So actors and audience shared the same light. You may think, if I tell you next, that by the middle of the 18th century, that's about 100 years, 150 years after he was gone, they could, in fact, turn lights off on an audience, on an audience and leave it on the stage. So it comes as a surprise, it's a whole century later, after they could do that, that the English ever put an audience in the dark. A whole century after they could do it, actors played in front of people sharing the light. So what? So everything. So the whole nature of what it meant to be, meant to go to a play, changed. What had been communal imagination, what had been everybody together sort of like, okay, yeah, okay, I will believe that's a forest if you want me to. I will believe what, you know, together doing that, became instead people sitting alone in the dark, maybe or maybe not imagining together, and actors having no idea how they're doing. except by one thing, laughter. And I guess an occasional one of these, I suppose. So that's the only way you knew if you were doing well. And so it's not a surprise that actors will go for cheap laughs in a darkened house, because it's one way to know there's some approval out there if the house is dark. Okay, so it's 1852 before the lights ever go out on audience, and it didn't even stick. Henry Irving did it in 1852. We know that in 1896, when Gilbert and Sullivan opened the Savoy Theater for their comic operas, they still left the lights on. But it's that very date when the first films were shown on the Champs-Élysées in Paris by the Lumiere brothers. It was that date, 1896. And to show a movie on a screen or a wall or whatever, you got to turn the lights off. One of the great things about PowerPoint is you don't exactly have to yet now. But if any of you have ever been in an art history class, I just pity art historians before PowerPoint, because poor old Betsy. Because they had to stand in front of darkened rooms with their little slides and keep people awake. It's a very hard thing to do. With movies, you had to turn the lights off. And at first, this is not a problem. First 10 years of film, they're so bad, nobody's really much going to them. You can't get to them. There's not much of a distribution center. But by 20 years later, Charlie Chaplin is the most famous person in the world. In the world. And everyone is going to movies. They're cheaper, on the one hand. And movies began to be the big competition for the entertainment dollar. And what plays did, what theater did to try to compete, was to be like movies. More and more to be like movies. So, what had been what I like to call the theater of imagination started to shift to what I will call the theater of illusion. What do I mean by those two different things? The very first films the Lumiere brothers made, it's really interesting, the very first films they made were of exotic places that you couldn't ordinarily see, like a gondola. You know, just somebody in a gondola in Venice. They went to Venice, they put up their equipment, then they came back, showed people in Paris who weren't going to get to Venice, here's the gondola. Like they showed Hessians marching. All right, this is what it looks like. See, I mean, so you were seeing famous places like the pyramid, and the whole idea was the illusion that you were there somehow. One of the funniest things is to look at the remarkable effect of the first time they ever showed a train arriving in a station. The illusion, which if you look at today, you can see it. I'm sure you can YouTube it and just go look at it. The first films ever shown of a train arriving in a station scared the hell out of the audience. They all went running. I mean, if you saw it, you'd think it was really silly that anybody would be afraid. But they wanted so much that sense of the illusion of being there. And what movies operate on is the illusion you are there. So when Peter Jackson makes the Lord of the Rings, the whole point is for Peter Jackson to envision Middle Earth or whatever, you know, and to show it to you. It is never for you to imagine it. It is for him to imagine it and for you to have the illusion that you are there. Well, that is the very opposite of the basic impulse of plays, which is, in fact, for you to know you're not there and to imagine it, to do it yourself. Now, obviously, an audience, if plays, as I am arguing, are trying to be like movies, then what they're trying to do more and more is to create a sense of illusion. So, probably you guys are too young even to ever have heard of it, but there was a play called Miss Saigon. All right, there you go. And a helicopter lands on the stage. Can I just say big effing deal? Have any of you ever seen Apocalypse Now? You want helicopters? Go see Apocalypse Now. Because you could do that. So the big deal about Miss Saigon was you see it, or a chandelier in what's the film? Right. Okay, great. So we have stage tricks and we can do this. But I will say that all those plays are doing are being movies manqué. That's what they're doing. They're being movies manqués. They are taking what they can do, and there's a lot you can do, to create an illusion, right? But they are moving away from the... And what they need very badly, by the way, for the illusion to work is for you not to be there. Because if everybody is looking at everybody else, sitting in chairs, and you know you just saw them in class, then you know what? You aren't in Vietnam. And you know you're not in Vietnam. Because after all, there's your friend Bailey. Can't be in Vietnam. Bailey's not in Vietnam. You know? So what plays begin to do, what more and more after the invention of film, was to turn the lights off and to try to be more and more like a movie. And so audiences began to expect to be in the dark. Now, there's some advantages to being in the dark. Anybody who, you know, when I was growing up, you took a date as soon as you could. You went to a movie and sat in the back row because you wanted to be in the dark. That's before you could drive, because after you could drive, you went to a drive-in, which is even better privacy-wise. So really and truly, though, entertainment became about being private, not about being a communal group imagining something. So here's what we are trying to do in Stanton, is we're trying to return people to the joy of being at a play. And tonight, my colleague and I are going to sort of show you a couple of those joys. We're going to talk about some of those things with you. But just to set some of this up, let me talk about what it is that... And this is what I don't understand when my fellow Shakespeare producers... I just came back from the Shakespeare Theatre Association meeting in Massachusetts. 70 companies were there. There are 140 Shakespeare companies in America, by the way. There are a lot more than, you know, 10 million people every summer go to see Shakespeare. That's three times as many people who go to Yankee Stadium every summer. That's pretty good. I mean, I think it's pretty good. But it ain't good enough. And it costs a lot of money. And everybody's in a financial crisis right now. And I wonder why my colleagues insist on leaving the lights off, turning the lights off. We have a bumper sticker at American Shakespeare Center. We do it with the lights on. And thank you very much. Thank you very much. Paul Menzer thanks you as well. I don't understand. And they build sets. Sometimes they'll hire a designer before they'll even hire the actors that are going to be in the show. They'll hire a designer because they want to build a set, a wonderful set that... What do you do with it? You know, you see the set, then maybe you change the set to another set. It costs you hundreds, well, not hundreds, but 10 times as much as it does for your actors, right? And then ultimately, all you are is a bad movie rather than being a good play. Because plays, I think, at their essence, are about a collaborative imagination. I love movies, and I have seen mixed media plays that I love, and I don't want you to think that anything else. And also, I think certain plays are written for a lot of design. But William Shakespeare's plays were not. They were written to be played on a bare stage, beautiful stage, as I've already said. The Blackfriars Playhouse is gorgeous. There's always a palace there, in a way. If you want a palace, you can refer to one. But it doesn't change, which is free for us. We never have to change our sets. We never hire a designer. And our audience gets to make that place anywhere, any place it wants it to be. So one great advantage for the theater entertainment world is financial. It's cheaper to put on Shakespeare the way he did it than to do it the way people do it today. But that's a minor thing compared to the two other things that plays can do that movies cannot ever do. No movie can put you in the room simultaneously with the people acting the show. They cannot do it. You go, so what? So everything. So it's no longer a collaboration. It is no longer about you and an actor. It's no longer about that moment. It is about moments in general. It's about a story. It's about a narrative. It may as well be a movie. And so if movies are winning the entertainment dollar for doing what they can do well, And what plays can't do well, why not turn the equation around? Why not have plays do something movies can never do? So why don't and I have a great, I haven't got my tickets yet, but I just spent a fortune to go to the Bruce Springsteen concert that's going to be here, and yeah, you bet. I want to just tell you a minute, just spend a moment talking to you about Bruce Springsteen and rock concerts, because that man is a genius at what he does. And what he does is he takes a crowd, and I've been in a stadium with 40,000 people, and he makes you think, really makes you think, that he knows you're there. He makes you think that your show, and it is different from any other show. He does it by lots of different ways. As you know, if you've ever been to any good rock concert is going to do this some. The spotlight will come and get your group. Your crowd will yell louder than anybody else. He'll tell you, actually says this. You are in concert, not at concert. You're part of this. You are my collaborator. I mean, he doesn't say the collaborator part. That's mine, thank you very much. But I'm not going to do that great stage slide either. So I get to say collaborator, and he says the other. He knows that when you've left that concert, you will feel somehow it's yours. And if you've ever been, you can be very, if you've ever been to a comedy club where the comic, somebody heckles the comic, I sure would like to hear a hiss. Jefferson was a putz. Good. Okay. Great. So there's some hissing, right? And he goes, and you have to deal with the hissing, and whatever way you do. I don't know what to say now that I've said Jefferson's a putz. I'm really, really, really sorry that I said Jefferson was a putz. Thank you very much. That comedian will make you know that the show is different. If you've ever been to a smaller venue and you yell out to some musician, "I want to hear this favorite thing," and he goes, "Okay," or even says, "Actually, I'm tired of doing that. Let me play another one for you that you haven't heard. Just kind of like it." You go, "Oh my God! I just changed the event this evening." Theater should be like that. That's how it was before the lights went out. It was about acknowledgement, about you feeling acknowledgement, and about a collective collaboration, a collective imagination. So I want to talk a little about that in terms of some things you probably already know about Shakespeare. So here comes the Shakespeare part of this. Thank you very much. Yes, yes, indeedy. You probably won't be surprised to know that when somebody is doing a soliloquy, which is a wonderful term, which I am going to try to undermine, because the word soliloquy, the root of that is being alone, is solo. Except for the audience, it is. If you do a good soliloquy, you're not alone. If you do a good soliloquy, it should be a dialogue. It should be with people. But anyhow, you wouldn't be surprised if I argued to you that Shakespeare expected his actor playing a soliloquy, maybe to look somebody in the eye while he's talking about it. You wouldn't be surprised. I don't think you should be. What you might not realize is the extent to which that practice is about making the language clear. Now, Bailey just saw Midsummer Night's Dream. And she said, so many people say, I hadn't even read it, and it was just like really, I mean, she knew it, but she like, it was just went. That's the way you should go. Because when you do Shakespeare right, you are picking people's, you are in, when you see it when you study it, how many of you have taken a Shakespeare course? Or think about high school. Remember there were these columns of speeches? Remember those things? And they were long, right? And you go, wow. Shakespeare is so long, so hard, But on stage, to be or not to be, which is 34 lines normally, isn't 34 lines. If you do it right, it's a collection of small lines. To be or not to be That is the question. Whether 'tis nobler, et cetera, et cetera. I go on. I don't want to go on. Each eye, each moment of dialogue, and I think this has something to do with, you probationaries, by the way, I think it has something to do with that, because it's about actually engaging. And if you do that, no speech is long, because it isn't a long speech. It's a series of imagined dialogues between you and someone. Now, you wouldn't be surprised, I think, to know that, you know, pretty much every show that Hamlet comes out, or anybody with a soliloquy, Macbeth, you know, anybody, might, in fact, catch someone's eye. You might not be surprised to know that a character speaking to a large group will sometimes try to pretend that the audience out there, you know, friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Okay, so what? You know, clearly Shakespeare kind of wrote that in. What I'm here to tell you is that every place in those plays requires a kind of participation in the play. Not just the soliloquies. All of it can be. So, I'm going to use this to go straight now. Before we do I'm going to show you something before that, because I think this is a little more extreme. What we're going to show you is even more extreme than the first thing. And don't worry, you don't have a line, so it's okay. So Sarah's going to help me with this. And may I move the essence? Okay, I'm going to move the essence. Sorry. If it's the essence, you don't have to care, do you? Because wherever it is, you are. So just don't worry about it. All right. So, all right. When I say that all moments in Shakespeare can be about the audience, I include even intimate moments between two actors. Normally, for example, this is from Much Ado About Nothing. It's in Act 4, Scene 1, a great play. Oh, they're so good. Man was good. This is from Much Ado About Nothing. Benedict, who has professed himself a woman hater almost, but somebody who's never, ever going to get married, has, after a disastrous wedding of the cousin of Beatrice, she's weeping there, you know, and they're alone at last. He's been tricked into realizing he's in love with her. She's been tricked into the same thing. They're alone at last. And he has a line that I think you would agree is clearly intended to be shared just by them. On a proscenium stage, with the lights out, and you can help me here by just pretending the lights are out and you can't be seen. The line goes like this: I love nothing in the world so well as you. It's not that strange. That's the line. It's a simple line. It looks like it's, how can you possibly make that about the audience? But remember, you've been sitting there listening to him say how he's never going to get married. He doesn't care what color her hair is or this or that or another thing. And he's gone on, and he's made himself. And he's been telling you this for the whole play. And now he makes a statement. So the line could also be, I love nothing in the world so well as you. Is not that strange? Because I did tell you something opposite, didn't I? Or I could go, I love nothing in the world so well as you. It's not that strange. Or I could ask her. I could always include you as a witness, because by God, you've been there from the beginning of the play, and you know there ain't no play before the beginning of the play. So you've been there the whole time. Okay? So that's an example, and I think you can do that. You could even do that with Hamlet and his mother talking about her sex life. You know, to stew and sweat in an seamed bed, and he could be talking to Gertrude and then turn to you. You know she did it, you know, because you're my witnesses. And isn't that awful? You can condemn her there by using you guys. You become part of the collaboration in the moment, in the imaginative moment. And it's really remarkable theater. And by the way, there is no not understanding Shakespeare when the actor's actually including you. It just goes away. If the actor knows what they're saying, it goes away. 98.5% of the words in Shakespeare are current usage in English words. And I would maintain to you that if you go to France and you know 98.5% of the words that you need to know, you're going to feel like you're fluent. Okay, so I just always love to deal with that percentage. What we're going to show you right now, though, and I'm not an actor, but Sarah is a scene. We're going to show it to you two ways. The first, just like I did before. The first one, you're to imagine yourself in the dark watching people on a proscenium stage. Now, I keep talking about proscenium stage, and you know what that is. It's like a picture frame. Shakespeare's stage, and this is why I had Bailey do this, Shakespeare's stage was thrust out into the audience, so the audience was kind of all around them. Again, they can see one another, right? But we're going to do it first as a proscenium stage. This is from Merchant of Venice. I play Nerissa, her handmaiden. Thank you very much. Okay. And she plays Portia, the richest woman in the world. And sort of background to this is that Portia, her father's died, and he's left a will. So Bill Gates is gone. He's got a daughter. And anybody can marry her who can choose the right casket. There's a gold, silver, and a lead one. Only if you compete to do that, you give up you give up the right ever to get married. So that's kind of the one way to keep everybody from coming, I guess, is that one provision. Okay? So we're talking about the suitors. And this is the way it would look on a proscenium stage where you're supposed to be kind of in three quarters, you know, so everybody can see you. Right? And if I wanted to go over there and she wants to go over there, this is how we do it. We go like that, like we don't have asses. You know, basically. Okay? All right. But what warmth is there in your affection toward any of these princely suitors that are already come?
I pray thee, overname them, and as thou namest them, I will describe them, and according to my description, level my affection.
First, there is the Neapolitan prince.
Aye, there is a colt indeed, for he doth nothing but talk of his horse, and he makes a great appropriation to his own good parts that he can shoe him himself.
Then there is the County Palatine. I say you by the French lord, Monsieur Le Bon.
God made him. Therefore, let him pass for a man. It's true that others have said to be a monster, but he. Wait, he had a horse better than the Neapolitan, a better bad habit of frowning than the Count Palatine. He is better than no man. I shall never requite him.
What say you then to Falconbridge, the young Baron of England?
No, I say nothing to him, for he understands not me nor I him. He hath neither Latin, French, nor Italian, and he will come into the court and swear that I have a courting north of the English. He is a proper man's picture, but alas, who can converse with a dumb show? How oddly he is suited! I think he bought his Dublin and Italy, his round.
How like you the young German, the Duke of Saxony's nephew?
Very highly in the morning when he is sober, and most highly in the afternoon when he is drunk. When he is best, he is a little worse than a man, and when he is worse, he is little better than a beast.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, just saw it. How many times did you laugh? Two. One really good one. That is not how this scene was done. That's how it's done on stage. That's how movies make this scene look. Okay. On the original stage, I feel quite confident of this. By the way, none of these characters that you just heard described, that's what she was doing, by the way, if you couldn't tell, she was describing characters, appear in the play. You never see them. They're not in the play. They're not backstage. They're usually played as though they're backstage. Well, they're not back there. There's nobody back there. They're not going to ever see these guys. This is what I think actually happened. It would have been in the thrust like this. She could not go into the audience, but she can get right up to it. And it'll look something like that, like this. But what warmth is there in your affection toward any of these princely suitors that are already come? First, there was the Neapolitan prince. Then there's the County Palatine.
He does nothing but come. I think she should say he will not have me too. He hears Mary Hale. And thank not. I fear he will prove the weeping philosopher when he grows old, being so full of unmannerly sadness in his youth. I'd rather be married to a death's head with bone in his mouth than to either of these.
How say you to the French lord, Monsieur Le Beau? What say you then to Falconbridge, the young Baron of England? How like you, the young German, the Duke of Saxony's nephew?
Very highly in the morning when he is sober. And most vilely in the afternoon when he is drunk. When he is his best, he is little worse than a man, and when he is his worst, he is little better than a beast.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sarah. Okay, we didn't cheat. It may have helped that you know each other some. But even if you hadn't, it's just as Don Rickles' humor. You're simply an audience, and you could do that, and we've done it. Many times is how we play this scene at our company. We think there are many scenes in Shakespeare where people who are not there are actually cast as audience members. But I want you to notice a couple of things. One, it was hugely more funny, wasn't it, to be about you. I mean, it's hugely more funny. But the other thing I want you to notice is how easy it was to understand. This is just a lot of words They're cute words. She's clever. But she ain't very funny until there's an object for her words, until it's about something, which is what plays do. But they can do all they want here. If they don't do something there, they begin to disappear. So that's part of my argument. Here's the second part of my argument. And I actually think for the Jefferson side, this is about the best thing I can say. The thing that makes us special as a species, the thing that makes us, you know, there are very organized species who get a lot of work done, who take care of their young, who, you know, make another generation, who create things, even if it's an anthill or a beehive. But there's only one species with imagination. The thing about us that is somehow, and we never think about it, most delicious, that it's inside of us, is that we can imagine. I don't know why you felt the first time you ever discovered that you could look at words on a page and have a picture in your head. But I still kind of remember when it happened to me. It was the black stallion. And I thought to myself, I hope I never die. This is such a joy. You know what I'm saying? When we argue with each other, you have a debating society here. What you basically do is you argue a point, you imagine an entire thing around your point, and the job of your opponent is to imagine the opposite in a way that engages yours. It is most remarkable what we as a human, we can do with our minds. Now, when you go into a movie, which I love to give up my imagination to a genius and let him take me or her take me wherever. But there's something even more fun about a good actor and great words. We're putting on Midsummer Night's Dream. If I don't see each and one of you there, I promise you, I'm going to come and get you. Yeah, did you see it? Is it good? Will they be sorry? Can I give them a money-back guarantee? I'm giving you a money-back guarantee. You go across the mountain, you see our production, you don't like it, my name is Ralph Allen Cohen, I'm at gmail.com, I will send you the rush ticket price. I'm only going to send you the rush ticket price, which is what now? $11. You'll get your $11 back. See something better than that, you go. But you have to write to me and say you really didn't like it. Okay, is that a deal? Y'all hearing me? Y'all here? Lights on? Okay, that's a good deal. All right. So in that play, there's a character named Oberon. He's the king of the fairies. And there was a moment, he's standing there, and the lovers from the other world in this play are rushed into his woods. And he wants to watch them. And he says, I will observe their quarrel or something like that. And then he says to you, to the audience, well, he says it first. He says, I think the line is, I am invisible and will overhear their conference. That's what he says. I am invisible and will overhear their conference. You know what? He doesn't become invisible, really. No special effects. But you know what else? He becomes invisible. You make him invisible. You just take his word for it. I am invisible, he says. You go, okay. And like lovers come out, and you're not surprised they don't see him. Makes perfect sense to you. No special effect. Your brain, your imagination makes that happen. To have that joy in a collective way is the most remarkable pleasure. And movies can't do it. If you made a movie, think about this. Because movies count on the illusion. And somebody in a movie said, and you're supposed to take seriously, I am invisible, and the movie didn't do anything to show you that he was. You'd think it was a bad movie, and you'd be right. But on the stage, it's the very opposite. On the stage, it's a great delight. I'm directing As You Like It right now for our master's program. We have an MFA in lit program. It's a great play. And out comes Rosalind, the character in Shakespeare, a female character with the most lines. She comes out with the fool and her cousin, and she says, so this is the Forest of Arden. There's your special effect. And it is. Nothing changes. Because she said, it's a wink, wink, nudge, nudge joke. Every audience knows they haven't gone anywhere. But now it's the Forest of Arden, and your brain makes it that. And the next character, and the clown says, yeah, now I'm in Arden. When I was at home, I was in a better place. Great joke to an audience. It's another joke. One of the most famous jokes, that, you know, I just love this. It's a joke. Hamlet comes out right before one of his most important soliloquies, and nobody makes more jokes about this audiences than Hamlet, and goes in front of the first audience, 3,000 people, and says, now I am alone. Isn't that a great joke? It's a great joke. It's a shared thing between you and the audience member. Now I want to give you one final example. I'm right on time. I think I'm on time. I can stop now, but we have one more little thing. Okay. You know all the twins in Shakespeare? Just twins everywhere. Twins everywhere. You make a movie about twins. And what's the one most important thing about those twins? Huh? What do they have to look like? They have to look like each other. Like, what did you say? The Olsen twins. Okay. They have to look like each other. We're not going to believe they're twins if they don't look like each other, right? In Shakespeare, that's not that on the stage in theater, that's not true at all. A twin is as it becomes a twin when we say it's a twin. Now I have a, let's see. We're gonna make twins. So Sarah, will you help me with this, please? Okay. So we're gonna make twins. Okay. So Sarah's gonna be one of the twins. So I need you're gonna be one of the twins.
Okay.
So I'm just sorry to surprise you a little bit with that, but I all right, that's fine. Oh well, we can make twins out of them instead. You wanna help me with that then? I just need to make you a twin. I don't need much. I need to borrow your blazer. Thank you very much. Well, do you think this will fit you if we use you?
Sure.
Okay, why don't we use you then? And who's got a blazer on like this? Somebody else have? Hey, you do, don't you? That's really good. Come on. No, you're up here. You're up here. All right, here we go. So here we go. Yep, very good point. So he's got glasses here. You can use mine if you want.
Okay, great.
Good, good. Okay, all right. Now, so we have glasses, and they have on a, right? Okay, and right, and you go put your right? And it's, you have a tie on. Oh, my God. Oh, I can't take this off because it's connected. Can somebody lend her a tie? Wait, how about let's make them really twins? Can we have your striped tie for a second? Thank you very much.
Sorry.
So yours isn't striped. It doesn't work as well. I'm sorry. Because they have to be twins. Okay, so here we go. Right, now we have... Yeah, I can do it very quickly. So, I've always wanted to do this. I only had daughters, and I always thought I would like to teach a young man how to do a tie, and I don't have a young man to do it with. This is going to be a Windsor badly done. Okay, all right. So it's going to be too short on you here. Okay, great. So now, okay. That didn't work there at the end. I did it too fast, but close enough. All right. So it's a tie. Oh, what is this? Oh, my microphone. Did that go bad on you? Am I all right? Here. You hold it. Okay. Wait, we're almost there. All right. So we're nearly there. The earrings. You don't have a hole, do you? All right, there we go. Now, actually, something's happening right now that's very important. All you have to do is make the obvious effort at a couple of things. So the earrings was a really good point to make because that stood out. You as an audience will accept the slightest amount of work toward this illusion, but it can't be stupid in the sense, I can use a man and a woman, no problem with that. Now I need to do one other thing. I need to give them, we're going to give them each a movement. Would you just walk, find some walk, you know, like from the silly walk or any kind of walk, to walk across the stage.
Okay, so just
like anything? Just to sing? Okay, good, fine, that's great. Oh, that's good, that's fine, fine. Great. All right. Now let's come back. Okay. All right. I'm going to give you a line, and I'll just use something because it's in my. I am not invisible. Can you say that line?
I am not invisible.
Can you say that line?
I am not invisible.
Now, maybe we ought to give them some one. Say maybe a one vocal thing about that. Y'all suggest something.
Southern
draws. Two southern draws. Can you do a southern? Okay, great. All right. So at the end, of Comedy of Errors, two twins meet, right? Never seen each other. We can use a lot of plays where two twins meet, but we'll use that one. So would you guys, would you enter from here using the walk, and you enter from there using the walk that you just had? And as you and I'm going to let you start. I want to let you start. You say, you explain to your newly found brother that you are not invisible, and he'll say he's not too, and then that'll be the end of our little demonstration. So, ladies and gentlemen, the twins from the end of Comedy of Errors. Thank you very much. Here we go. Ah, terrific! Thank you very much. You bet. Okay. Movies can't do that. It was delightful. Was it not delightful? I think it was delightful. It was delightful. They can't do that. Movies cannot do that. It is something only plays can do. That would be unforgivable in a film. That would be... So, you know, one of the things, Ben Jonson was a very literal playwright, and he once complained that Shakespeare wrote a play about twins, two sets of twins, when he couldn't, he himself, he says, and they didn't look much alike. Ben Jonson, you lose. In fact, I would even tell you, I don't know if you've ever seen Comedy of Errors, if those twins look too much alike, you can't make out the plot. You need to know which twin is which, or you can't make it out. If the twins look too much alike, the joke's on the audience, and that's not where the joke's supposed to be. The joke's supposed to be the people in the play. They actually need to look not alike, so you can keep up with it. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Is it time for questions? Two or three questions? Thank you. Thank you. Bailey says I have time for two or three questions. Oh, great.
I'm told by English teachers that not only did the players interact with the audience would interact with the players both. Do you encourage this in your kids?
That's a great question. I think probably bad playwrights had some trouble with that. There are moments in Shakespeare where, and we've had enormous experience with this. I mean, I think our actors know what to do with this better than any troupe in the world. There's a moment in Richard II where, and that's a great example, John Harrell's playing Richard II. He comes out and he says, will no man say amen? It's just one of his lines in a long speech. Will no man say amen? Right. And the first time he ever did it, nobody did. I mean, it just depends on your house. And I don't think he really expected the first time it happened. But the second show, it was a great house, and they were into it. And when he said that, the answer came back to him, amen. In fact, from several people. And then he knew exactly what to do with it, and he went, well then, and this is actually in the lines, well then, amen. His line actually means, well, then amen to the fact that if nobody's going to say amen, I'll say amen to that. But when he heard the amen come at him, he went, well, then amen. And everybody said amen. So he played off of that. There's a great speech from Falstaff in Henry IV, Part 1, where he asks, what is honor? And he says, can honor mend a leg? No. You know, can honor heal a wound? No. And I think it's a call and response, and I think the first Falstaff sort of expected it. And I'll just finish with the best example that I know of how our actors can play that. And what I love. Now, look, if an audience is trying to be mischievous, what will happen, and I can tell you right now, if the show is actually good and an audience is trying to be disruptive, the rest of the audience, especially in the light, will take care of that particular person. But this is a great example. It's a high school production of Hamlet. And our Hamlet, played by Ben Kearns, it's when Hamlet comes out and Claudius is praying. And Hamlet could kill him if he wanted to. And he says, And the line is something, and I'm sorry, I don't have the line at me, but he goes, shall I kill him? And some kid, we have stools on the stage like they did at the Blackfriars. And there was a kid on the stage who said, yes. And he didn't mean it like a heckler. I mean, he went, yes, like that. And I after went over to him, Ben went over to him and he went, while he's at his prayers, which is the next line. While he's at his prayers, and the kid says, he's got to die. I mean, like that. And then Ben says, he says, but now he'll go to heaven. I need to get him when he's in his bed, you know, in his sin and he's drunk and whatever thing like that, so he'll go to hell. And the kid goes, I mean, just, you know, it's this amazing moment of theater where the audience was actually part. And so I think if your teacher was saying that they were heckled a lot or they were very loud, and I do not believe that, because they pay their money to see a show and they don't really want to hear one another. But I think if it was appropriate, it happened. And I think it was less difficult for an audience member then to respond. One more question maybe? Yeah. Bless you. I mean, I talk about static all the time. You know, actors will do it sometimes. You know, they think they need to do too much. Again, let your production machines work. If you do too much, then you're going to kill that joy. And let me just say, too, that movies are in trouble. As also, inevitably in trouble. As you know, you can pull out your iPhone right now and watch a movie. And so movies are kind, and you also know that if you want the big screen effect, all you have to do is buy yourself a 52-inch or turn off the lights, sit close, and have a good sound system. You know that now. And so I think in the long run, that kind of illusion thing is going to become, it's going to be funny, it's funny, it's going to become more and more private. It's going to become more and more like books in some funny way. But what we're going to lose, and this is what I think theater really holds for us, we're going to lose the beauty of the communal experience. And why go to a theater that turns off the lights on you to have a communal experience? Come see us. Come see, you know, or go to a good concert where you're having a communal moment where the idea of congregation is still there. I think it's really important. So I thank you again. There was another question, and if that person, absolutely. There was one other question over here. You're welcome. Okay, you said multiple props, right? Multiple. No, I know. But before that, you said that, because I never said that an actor playing multiple parts distracts. I think that in fact, up to a certain place, it can be really a wonderful effect to have the same. We have 12 actors, and you know we do plays where there are 50 something characters in the play, which means that somebody's going to have to double and or triple or quadruple or quintuple. And to do that, we're going to have to find ways to make it clear that this person who is the same person is playing a character who, excuse me, is a different character. Shakespeare played that game himself, and I'll finish with this because it's a lovely thing, again, that you could never do in the movies. So, and I'm just going to do this really quickly. I would like to have you come up, please. This is the beginning of Winter's Tale. Okay, at the beginning of Winter's Tale, I'm Leontes. This is my wife, Hermione. Great to see you. I need a little girl. You come on up. Only at the beginning of this, you're not a little girl. You're a little boy. This is our son. This is our son. This is our son, Mamilius. Hi, Mamilius. And then I need an old, really old dude. You'll do. Come on up. This is my counselor. This is my good friend and counselor, Antigonus. And his wife, Paulina. Okay, this is at the beginning of the play, and I think I probably left somebody out, but this is, these people are all alive at the beginning of the play. This is a tragic comedy. In the course of the play, I suspect her of adultery, and she didn't, and the gods get angry at me, and they kill this little boy. The little boy dies. So will you go sit over there for a second? The little boy dies. She has a baby that I suspect is someone else's, and I take the baby, and I give it to my counselor, Mamilius, and I'm sorry, Antigonus, and I tell him to take it and leave it somewhere. He goes to play, leaves it in Bohemia, and is chased off the stage by a bear in the very famous line, exit pursued by a bear, and is killed. So you go to sit down there. This leaves us, and it's a tragedy. But you know what? The second half of that play is kind of a comedy. No place in the play does the old man, the two characters who are older, another counselor named Camillo, at no time appears on the stage at the same time as Antigonus. And the little boy, this is 15 years later, now there's a daughter named Perdita. If the boy, and you know boys play women's parts, if the boy plays Perdita and the same actor plays Camillo, who played Antigonus, and in the end of the play, true, they're different characters, but in another way, no harm, no foul. Thank you very much. That's all. Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you. Oops, I'm making my little notes. Sorry.